This is our league, and this is your league. From the 55-yard line on CFL America Radio and the Sports History Network.
America's football palaces, Sunday's cathedrals. During the 1970s, more than 100 million weekend worshipers turned out to hear their favorite gridiron gospel.
Down to one big play. Fourth down and 10 yards to go. Hang on to your hats. Here come the Steelers out of the huddle. 22 seconds remaining. Gary Bradshaw at the control. And Bradshaw back and looking again. Bradshaw running out of the pocket. Looking for somebody to throw to. Fires it downfield. And there's a collision. That's caught out of the air. The ball is pulled in by Franco Harris. Harris is going for a touchdown for Pittsburgh. Harris is going. 5 seconds left on the clock. Franco Harris pulled in the football. I don't even know where it came from.
Franco Harris's immaculate reception. One play among thousands in a decade that had it all. This is the story of 10 years of pro football. It's a story of champions, teams that set the standard for all the rest. And above all, it's a story about men, great men, whose runs set the records, whose teams won the titles, and whose magic made the memory. The memories that will forever be a part of the Super 70s. As the decade began, a protest-weary nation said goodbye to the turmoil of the 60s. A spirited new era was arriving. It was a self-indulgent era, preoccupied with personal appearance and artistic self-expression. Pro football was a reflection of the times. It was an age of superheroes, where one mild-mannered pass catcher named William Johnson could doff his disguise and become Billy White Shoes. And above all, it was an age of innovation. Early in the decade, Kansas City Chief wide receiver Elmo Wright unveiled a brand new form of self-adulation. Before long, everybody was punctuating scoring plays with their own stylized steps. Sadly, the 70s would be without Vince Lombardi. Lombardi's legendary Packer teams dominated the 60s, translating Lombardi's fundamental designs into five world championships. Lombardi's death and the collapse of the Packer dynasty created a power vacuum in pro football that wasn't filled until 1972. Then, along came Don Shula and the Miami Dolphins. The Dolphins achieved greatness because Shula's emphasis on fundamentals made them into a team strikingly similar to Lombardi's Packers. His line's execution on the power sweep would have made Lombardi smile. His ball control back Larry Zonka was cut from the same sturdy stock as Green Bay's Jim Taylor. His so-called no-name defense, like the Packers, didn't brutalize opponents. It simply didn't let them score. And finally, his quarterback, like Green Bay's Bart Starr, was a model of efficiency. Through 4 weeks of the 72 season, the Dolphins were undefeated. Then, Shula lost quarterback Bob Greasy to a fractured ankle. But just as Lombardi had Zeke Brakowski in reserve, so did Shula have backup quarterback Earl Morrow. The 72 Dolphins won 16 straight games and advanced to Super Bowl VII. There, only the Washington Redskins stood between them and the NFL's first perfect season. Defeated the Washington Redskins 14-7, the first of two consecutive Super Bowl wins for Don Shula. The Miami Dolphins, the new Green Bay Packers. Hash marks, a series of lines between which every offensive play begins. Before the 72 season, they were spaced 40 feet apart. In 72, the rules makers narrowed the distance to 18 and a half feet. Their intention was to put more offense into the game. Their logic was that by giving wide receivers more room to operate, they would encourage the forward pass. Instead, they ushered in the year of the runner. Ball control was in, and a halfback with elusiveness was essential to success. Even more in demand were fullbacks who could string out pursuit, then escape down the wider field. The 1972 season produced more 1,000-yard rushers and more total rushing yards than any season before. A vintage year for pro football's ball carrier. The decade as a whole produced some of the greatest ball carriers of all time, among whom three stood above the rest. One was Chicago's Walter Payton. The second was Houston's Earl Campbell. The third was Buffalo's O.J. Simpson. Among the three of them, there wasn't a single ounce of quit. Over the decade, O.J. Simpson's accomplishments were the most sensational. The Southern California sprinter had 5,000-yard seasons, 36 100-yard games, and became only the second man in history to rush for 10,000 yards in a career.
And now it's for the 2,000, boys.
And on a snowy day in 1973, he became the only man ever to rush for 2,000 yards in a single season.
O.J. running left. There it is!
He did it! He did it!
Yeah! I just wonder if the three of us at this moment fully realize what it has been our great privilege to watch O.J. Simpson run for 2,000 yards in one season.
O.J. Simpson, the player of the decade. The Pittsburgh Steelers, the team of the decade, a team sustained by its defense. During the 70s, there was no tougher assignment in the sport than a close encounter with a steel curtain. Since their founding in 1933, Steeler teams were always hard-hitting. But four decades of issuing headaches had not produced a single NFL championship. Then the Steelers hired Chuck Knoll. Knoll's first pick in the 69 college draft was Mean Joe Greene, a man with no fear. The following year, Knoll drafted a small college quarterback named Bradshaw. For 6 years, Knoll used the draft like an artist, with each stroke adding new dimensions to his masterpiece. And by 1974, Mona Lisa was hungry for a title. They were underdogs in the 74 AFC title game. They left Oakland with a conference championship. They arrived in New Orleans for Super Bowl IX like a college team at homecoming. The Minnesota Vikings didn't stand a chance. By Super Bowl X, they were in a class all by themselves. The Pittsburgh Steelers, a young dynasty created through the draft, a team that would rewrite the record books before the decade was over. In Washington, D.C., the only thing bigger than Watergate were the Redskins. The cagey codgers from the Capitol. The over-the-hill gang, enthusiastic old pros whose inspirational leader was head coach George Allen. Allen was an emotional coach, a hard-driving perfectionist with a politician's approach to people. Only President Nixon shook more hands around Washington. Allen's 72 Redskins won the NFC Eastern Division title, and with each passing week, they reached a new emotional high, a tribute to their coach. For of all George Allen's coaching talents, none was more unique than his ability to extract the child from the man. In December of 72, Allen's old pros took the field against the Dallas Cowboys with a Super Bowl berth at stake. It would be George Allen's finest hour.
Just remember this, 40 men together can't lose, okay?
Die! 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 Die!
George Allen's Over the Hill Gang lost to Miami in Super Bowl VII, but simply getting there was a hats-off achievement. The Los Angeles Rams didn't play in a Super Bowl until 1980, despite winning seven straight NFC West titles. Five of those came under Chuck Knox, a man whose only coaching liability was his inability to beat the Minnesota Vikings in the playoffs. Three times the Rams were favored. Three times they lost. The Vikings were the NFC's real hard luck story. A team as eccentric as its quarterback, all-time total yardage leader, Fran Tarkenton. They were good enough to win four NFC titles. But in Super Bowl competition, Bud Grant's team was a flop. In Super Bowl IV, they were overwhelmed by the Kansas City Chiefs. In Super Bowl VIII, they were overrun by the Dolphins. In Super Bowl IX, they were overpowered by the Steelers. In Super Bowl XI, the Vikings lined up opposite another great team that had never won the big one. But against the Vikings, the Oakland Raiders were all business. Their game plan was clearly defined, and their execution was flawless. The Oakland Raiders came from the old American Football League with a dynamic owner who still believed the way to win was to throw the football. Winning the AFC West was never a problem. Beating Pittsburgh in the playoffs was. But in 76, a fired-up Raider club contained the steel curtain, and Ken Stabler passed the Raiders to the AFC title. To the Rose Bowl, where the Raiders stole the show from the Minnesota Vikings.
It's going to be a touchdown! Willie Brown! 45, 40, 35, 30, 25, 20.
Old man Willie! He's going all the way! Touchdown, Raiders!
After years of heartbreaking playoff defeats, the Oakland Raiders were the new world champions. Denver, Colorado, the site of 1977's most colorful sports phenomenon. They called it Broncomania, a curious form of football fanaticism that could strike any member of the family. The man behind the madness was Denver's beloved first-year coach, Red Miller. Miller told his players they could unseat the Oakland Raiders as conference champions. In fact, he insisted on it. To quarterback his club, he traded for veteran Craig Morton. Morton arrived in Denver as a born-again Christian, a man who had the Lord in his heart and who found Moses in the corner. Their 77 schedule was the league's toughest. But by the day of the AFC title game, Miller's players were doing the insisting. The Oakland Raiders were beaten.
This organization's been down for a long time. The Denver Broncos are now earning the respect of the entire league, and that's what we want. We want to be known as a good team, as a good football team, which we are. And we're going to go on from here, we hope.
On they went indeed to the Louisiana Superdome for Super Bowl XII.
Hey, listen now. Four quarters, 60 minutes, and we're the champions. Yeah! All right, let's go, baby!
And there, they ran headlong into doomsday. The Dallas Cowboys' manhandling of the Broncos came as no real surprise, for throughout the decade, the Dallas Cowboy star was a symbol of football excellence. The man behind the Cowboys' success was head coach Tom Landry, the game's most creative strategist. The man who translated Landry's ideas into action was quarterback Roger Staubach, the focal point of pro football's most sophisticated attack. Cowboys were one of the decade's most successful teams, a solid organization with a wealth of great athletes. In 1977, they acquired a special athlete, Heisman Trophy winner Tony Dorsett. Not since Dwayne Thomas had the Cowboys owned a running back so explosive. so it was that in Super Bowl XII, Dallas's superior resources struck midnight on Denver's Cinderella season. An AFC club lost a Super Bowl for only the second time in the decade. Not surprisingly, Tom Landry's Dallas Cowboys were responsible on both occasions. Even the most successful NFL head coaches live in a shadowy world of uncertainty. It's a world where job security is non-existent, and each man's game face under pressure is different.
First thing, I want you to make sure that you take as much liquid as you possibly can. It's going to be hot out there.
It's a world where the bottom line is victory, and every word spoken is calculated toward achieving it.
We're at the crossroads. And no question about that. But it's not the end of the world. I just want us to do a job that we're capable of doing. If we die together. You can get it done. You can get it done. What's more, you gotta get it done. Let's go.
The team that Lou Saban's Buffalo Bills had to get it done against was the Miami Dolphins, a team that beat Buffalo 20 times in 20 games during the 70s. This loss in 1974 was typical of Buffalo's frustration. For Lou Saban, this was a particularly difficult defeat. For Miami's winning touchdown came in the game's final minute.
Boy, oh boy. 56 seconds and we let them get off the hook. Well, we're coming after them again next week.
Get 'em next week. Advice the Philadelphia Eagles had grown accustomed to hearing. For in 12 years, the Eagles had not found the handle on a winning season. In 1976, Eagles owner Leonard Toews hired Dick Vermeil to turn things around. And by the 78 season, a perennial loser was flying high toward the playoffs. The 78 Eagles won six of their first 11 games. But in a Week 12 must-win game in New York, the Giants led by five with just seconds to play. Dick Vermeil's club needed a miracle.
And Pazarczyk fumbles the football. It's picked up by Herman Edwards. 15, 10, 5, touchdown Eagles! I don't believe it! I don't believe it! I do not believe what has occurred here, ladies and gentlemen! Talk about miracles, folks! I do not believe this one, but it has happened as the Eagles beat the Giants 19-17 before a shocked crowd at the Meadowlands.
The Eagles had been granted a reprieve. And on the season's final Sunday, Vermeil would not allow them to waste the opportunity.
Well, guys, 12 years. 12 years have gone by since the Eagles have been a winner. We're going to come out winners today. You've worked like winners. You've played like winners. Sure, we've won a couple we should have lost. But I'll tell you something else. We've lost a few we should have won. We're right where we ought to be, playing for the first winning season since 1966. Hey, God love all of you.
Hey, all right. Good talk.
The Philadelphia Eagles were winners.
That was for you.
No, that's for you.
You deserve it, baby.
Pro football is a game of strategy, a game won or lost on execution. But during the Super 70s, as the old saying goes, sometimes it was better to be lucky than good.
Oakland trails 20-14. 10 seconds left. The crowd takes up a chant of defense. Robiski and Banaszak are the backs. Slot right. Branch inside. Bradshaw, Staber back. Here comes the rush. He sidesteps. Can he throw? He can't. The ball flipped forward is loose. A wild scramble. 2 seconds on the clock. Casper grabbing the ball. It is rolled a fumble. Casper has recovered in the end zone. The Oakland Raiders have scored on the most zany, unbelievable, absolutely impossible dream of a play. Madden is on the field. He wants to know if it's real. They said yes. Get your big butt out of here. He does. There's nothing real in the world anymore. The Raiders won the football game. 52,000 people minus a few lonely Raider fans are stunned. This one will be relived forever.
If you catalog the decade's incredible football events, you'd find that most of them began as pass plays.
It's deflected, and it's caught! It's caught! It's caught! Touchdown, Falcons on a deflected pass! I can't believe it!
Atlanta's famous Big Ben play came in 1978 and lifted the Falcons into the playoffs. It was one of the most memorable completions in the new age of the forward pass. The rules makers were partially responsible. The most significant change made it illegal to touch a wide receiver downfield. In effect, the new rule removed the obstacles from the paths of pro football's fastest men. The long bomb was back. Nobody threw the ball more successfully than the San Diego Chargers. In 1979, Charger quarterback Dan Fouts threw for 4,082 yards, a new single-season record. And of course, no new trend escaped the eye of the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Pittsburgh Steelers went from ball control to the bomb. And as the decade came to a close, they were ready to climb back to the top. If Father Time could put his summary of the Super 70s into words, this is what he would say. A decade has come. A decade is gone. And so very much has changed. The meek have risen to inherit the earth. The mighty have fallen away. I've ripened a new generation and launched them on courses to fame. I have added some years to glorious careers and watched men leave the game. I've given men time to look silly. Time to feel helpless and lame. It's a chorus of laughs, a choir of fools, when men play a little boy's game. Above all, I've given them memories of plays and days and years.
Tom Dempsey will have tried to kick the longest field goal in National League history. Here's a snap. The ball is down. Dempsey kicks. It's on the way. It is. Good. It's good. It's good. The Saints have won. The Saints have won.
Tom Dempsey's 63-yard field goal. One of the decade's most memorable plays. As for memorable days, few compare with the 1974 Thanksgiving Day performance of a Dallas Cowboy quarterback. On that day, Roger Staubach was injured. But as a nation watched, three different Redskin leads were overcome by an untested passer named Clint Longley. This one in the game's closing seconds. Clint Longley did not go on to NFL stardom, But nobody who witnessed his 1974 Thanksgiving Day performance will ever forget it. As for memorable seasons, either of Tampa Bay's first two had its fun-filled moments. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers lost their first 26 games and became the laughing stock of pro football. But their most memorable season came in 1979, the year they advanced to the NFC Championship game, just one win shy of the Super Bowl. And finally, there is the lasting memory of a team that made all the plays through four Super Bowl seasons. In Super Bowl XIII, the Pittsburgh Steelers defeated the Dallas Cowboys for their third world championship. Here were the Packers of the 70s, a team that distinguished every game in which it took part. The envy of all their vanquished foes. In January of 1980, the Steelers were the feature attraction at Super Bowl XIV. Their loyal fans were there too, there to watch perhaps the greatest football team of all time take that final step toward pro football immortality. The Pittsburgh Steelers, the team of the decade known as the Super 70s.